watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, MIT professor and public intellectual Noam Chomsky. He spoke March 4th at Binghamton University to a standing room only audience on the increased threat of nuclear proliferation as a result of U.S. actions, and called upon Americans to organize and remedy the deficit of democracy in the United States. Professor Herbert Bix, who arranged for Chomsky's appearance, gives the introduction.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Herbert Bix. Now it is a great honor for Binghamton University and a joy for me personally to welcome Noam Chomsky, who needs no introduction. Let us applaud him for all the work he has done for peace and justice over 45 years, and for bringing the light of reason to so many world issues. Thank you.
A standing ovation for Noam Chomsky.
Thank you. Herb's timing was very good. It was exactly enough time for them to get me wired up. So you should be able to hear, I hope. The selection of issues that should rank high on the agenda of concern is naturally a subjective matter, but there are at least two that demand high priority because they are literally matters of survival. One of them is the threat of nuclear war, and the second is environmental disaster, both of which are very real. One of the many respected strategic analysts warning of the increasing threat of nuclear war is a former NATO planner, Michael McGuire, writing in Britain's leading journal of international affairs. He warns that, I'll quote, under current U.S. policies, a nuclear exchange is ultimately inevitable, and unless these policies are sharply changed, we are virtually certain to see a return to nuclear arms racing involving intercontinental ballistic systems, space-based assets, reactivating the danger of inadvertent nuclear war with a probability that will be extremely high, comparing the two crises that literally threaten survival. McGuire has this to say: by comparison with global warming, the cost of eliminating nuclear weapons would be small, but the catastrophic results of global nuclear war would greatly exceed those of progressive climate change because the effects would be instantaneous and could not be mitigated. The irony of the situation is that it is in our power to eliminate the threat of global nuclear war, but climate change cannot be evaded. Well, he's right on both counts. Means are available and are well known to eliminate the threat of instantaneous nuclear destruction. And while the timing of climate change can be debated, there's no escaping the fact, unless maybe you're in the White House, that the longer we delay in confronting it, the worse it's likely to be. Well, these considerations bring up a third crisis, namely the government of the world's leading power is increasing the likelihood of the two threats to survival. And it's important to stress government because the population does not agree, not very surprisingly. So just to take one example, the standard observation, which you've all read, that the United States is almost alone in rejecting the Kyoto Protocols is correct only if the phrase United States excludes its population, which strongly favors the Kyoto Pact. In fact, support is so strong that the majority of Bush voters believe that he too favors U.S. participation in the treaty because it's such an obvious thing to believe. More generally, this is just one illustration of the fact that voters were seriously deluded about the positions of the political parties in the last election. In fact, only 10% even knew what the stand was, 10% of voters. And that's not because of lack of interest or mental deficiency, but because elections are designed that way, purposely. Well, issues like these, and there are many of them, bring up a fourth crisis that should be of particular concern to us, and that is the very visible decline of functioning democracy. More generally, the ominous drift of the world's dominant power towards becoming a failed state. That's a fashionable term. It's conventionally applied to states that are regarded as enemies or portrayed as potential threats to our security or as needing our intervention to rescue the population, often by demolishing them in the process. A primary characteristic of failed states is their inability or unwillingness to protect their citizens from violence. They are, furthermore, what are sometimes called outlaw states, which regard themselves as beyond the reach of international law and norms of civilized behavior. And if they have democratic forms, they suffer from what's called a democratic deficit, which deprives the formal democratic institutions of any real substance. Well, it's not hard to recognize those characteristics painfully nearby. And more important, all of this is surely under our control if we're not content to observe passively and obediently. I'll return to some simple steps at the end. But the first step, transparently, is awareness and understanding. Without that, you can't proceed. So to begin with the most serious and imminent crisis, apart from specialist circles, very little attention is paid to the threat of nuclear war, and more importantly, to our own role in escalating the threat. Now, of course, we can't say that the threat is unknown. We've just passed the 50th anniversary of an appeal to the people of the world by Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein. Extraordinary appeal. They posed a choice that, in their words, is stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? Well, war has certainly not been renounced in the last half century. Quite the contrary. By now, the world's hegemonic power accords itself officially the right to wage war at will under a doctrine of what's called anticipatory self-defense with unstated bounds. Well, as we all know, the doctrine is now being applied in Iraq and is being threatened in Iran. And the U.S. is backed in that stance by the spear carrier for the Pax Americana, and that's McGuire's term for Blair's Britain in the Journal of the Royal Institute of International Affairs. For the warrior and the spear carrier, international law, treaties, rules of world order, are double-edged. They are sternly imposed on others with much self-righteous posturing, but they're dismissed as irrelevant for themselves. Now, throughout history, that stance has been familiar among states that have, or at least believe they have, unchallengeable power. The consequences are also well known, but historical analogies don't have much force because the stakes now are so much higher, literally survival of the species. McGuire is not alone. He's joined by many others, in fact, most specialists, in warning of the virtual inevitability of nuclear war. One of them is Kennedy Johnson, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who recalled that the world, his words, came within a hair's breadth of nuclear disaster during the missile crisis of 1962, and goes on to say that that threat is once again severe. Quoting McNamara now, he warns of apocalypse soon unless there is a sharp change in current U.S. nuclear weapons policy, which is immoral, illegal, militarily unnecessary, and dreadfully dangerous, creating unacceptable risks to other nations and to our own. Both the risk of accidental or inadvertent nuclear launch, which is unacceptably high and is terminal, and of nuclear attack by terrorists. He endorsed the judgment of Clinton's Defense Secretary, William Perry, that there's a greater than 50% probability of a nuclear strike on U.S. targets within a decade. That's referring to a dirty bomb, not the ultimate disaster. The threats are well understood, and they are being consciously enhanced. The Iraq invasion is only the most glaring example. Harvard University strategic analyst Graham Allison reports what he calls the consensus in the national security community, of which he's been a part, that a dirty bomb attack is inevitable and an attack with a nuclear weapon, a terminal attack, highly likely if fissionable materials, which are the essential ingredient, are not retrieved and if their further production is not terminated. I'll come back to the crucial question of controlling production. On retrieving fissionable materials, there has been some success since the early 1990s. That's under the initiatives of Senators Sam Nunn and Richard Lugar. But Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the rest put to the side their programs to avert inevitable nuclear terror, just as they sidelined the war on terror generally, so that they could devote their energies to driving the country to war, and then their efforts to contain somehow the catastrophe that they created in Iraq. In the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the ultimate in respectability and not given to hyperbole, two well-known strategic analysts warned that Bush administration military programs and its general aggressive stance carry, in their words, an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. The reasons are straightforward. Pursuit of total security by one state entails the insecurity of others, and they're almost certain to react. They'll make use of the terrifying technology that's being developed in Rumsfeld's transformation of the military, still quoting, which will assuredly diffuse to the rest of the world. And in the context of competition and intimidation, the familiar action-reaction cycle creates rising danger, potentially an unmanageable one. Hence, transformation as currently being practiced carries an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. Well, the authors express the hope that the threat that the U.S. government is posing to its own population and to the world will be countered by a coalition of peace-loving states. led by China. We've come to a pretty pass when thoughts like that are expressed at the heart of the establishment. And what they imply about the state of American democracy is no less startling. So the authors don't even consider the possibility that the American people could have anything to do about this. We have to wait for China to do it. They bring up China because, as they point out, of all the nuclear states, it has maintained by far the most restrained pattern of military deployment. Furthermore, China, for some years, has been leading the efforts at the United Nations to overcome the unilateral U.S. refusal to reserve space for peaceful purposes. The Clinton administration refused to join the rest of the world, apart from Israel, in a renewal and extension of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, and they also immobilized the UN Disarmament Commission by barring any moves towards prevention of an arms race in outer space. And they gave the reasons explicitly. We should all know them. Clinton's Space Command called for, I'm quoting it, dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment, much in the way armies and navies did in earlier years, but now with a sole hegemon, which must develop space-based strike weapons, enabling the application of precision force from, to, and through space. U.S. intelligence and the Space Command agreed in the Clinton years that such measures will be needed because, quoting again, globalization of the world economy will lead to a widening economic divide along with deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation, hence unrest and violence among the have-nots, much of it directed against the United States. The U.S. must therefore be ready for precision strike from space as a counter to the worldwide proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by unruly elements. That's a likely consequence of the recommended military programs, just as a widening divide, deepening economic stagnation, and so on, are the anticipated consequences of the specific form of international integration that's misleadingly called globalization and free trade and the doctrinal system. Space program falls within the framework of the officially announced Clinton doctrine that the U.S. is entitled to resort to unilateral use of military power to ensure uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. And notice that, taken literally, that's far more extreme than anything that's come out of the Bush administration. Clinton's strategic command added to that Washington should portray itself as irrational and vindictive if its vital interests are attacked, including the threat of first strike with nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states. Furthermore, nuclear weapons always cast a shadow over any crisis or conflict that extends the reach of conventional power. That strategic doctrine is not new. And it's shared across the narrow political spectrum. So President Carter's defense secretary, Harold Brown, called on Congress to fund strategic nuclear capabilities because with them, our other forces become meaningful instruments of military and political power available for use throughout the Third World. You use such means only against defenseless targets, of course. It's worth remembering that while Bush and company are extreme in their reactionary statist radicalism, they're at the extreme of a dangerously narrow spectrum of the political class. That's why all these things are kept quiet. It's not things the population is supposed to learn about, though technically they're public. The threats are becoming much more serious as the Bush planners extend Clinton's doctrine of control of space for military purposes to, quoting now, to ownership of space, which may mean instant engagement anywhere in the world. They emphasize these phrases so that their meaning will be clearly understood. That puts the purpose is to put any part of the world at risk of instant destruction, thanks to sophisticated global surveillance and lethal offensive weaponry in space. Right now, the U.S. is responsible for 95% of the total world spending for militarization of space, and it's only to be expected that potential targets will react, increasing the danger to everyone. And that's, in fact, already happening. As was expected, Russia reacted to Bush's vast increase in offensive military capacity by sharply increasing its own capacities aimed at the United States. China's following suit, expanding offensive capacities to preserve its deterrence. Very small now, but it'll grow. China's so far reluctant reaction will have a ripple effect in India first, then Pakistan in response to India, then beyond. Both U.S. and Chinese analysts recognize that, almost in the same words, that current U.S. plans are likely to set off an arms race in space. Now, that includes what's euphemistically called missile defense, which is understood on all sides to be a first strike weapon. The program of missile defense is commonly criticized as a colossal waste of money because it won't work. That's the good news. It's far more dangerous if there's any sign that it might work. Adversaries have to make a worst-case analysis, and if there's any sign that it might work, they will react by developing means to overwhelm or bypass it, which are a lot more easy than constructing it, and that will greatly increase the threat to survival. In fact, it's already happening. In the current issue, the March issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is sort of a standard monitor on these things, they report that, quote, the emerging U.S. anti-ballistic missile defense system has provoked a direct Russian response, including advanced missiles and new, more sophisticated warheads. It's exactly as was predicted several years ago, the authors also point out. Senator Nunn, who, as I said, has been in the lead of the conservative senator, been in the lead of these anti-war efforts for a long time, he wrote recently that the chances of an accidental, mistaken, or unauthorized nuclear attack might be increasing. Because of current policy choices, we're running an unnecessary risk of an Armageddon of our own making. Like the others, Nunn is referring to the sharp expansion of U.S. military programs, which tilt the strategic balance in ways that make Russia more likely to launch upon warning of an attack without waiting to see if the warning is accurate. And that's no joke. The threat is enhanced by the fact, I'm continuing to quote him, that the Russian early warning system is in serious disrepair and more likely to give a false warning of incoming missiles. And U.S. systems are very dangerous. U.S. reliance on the high alert, hair trigger nuclear posture allows missiles to be launched within minutes, forcing our leaders to decide almost instantly whether to launch nuclear weapons once they have a computer warning of an attack. That robs them of the time they may need to gather data, exchange information, gain perspective, discover an error, and avoid a catastrophic mistake. And we know of our own systems that there are hundreds of such errors just caught in time. The anticipated Russian reaction to Bush administration aggressive militarism, Nunn says, increases the risk of an Armageddon of our own making, well beyond even the current intolerable level. Well, these dangers are being consciously escalated by the threat and use of violence, which, just as predicted, is stimulating nuclear proliferation, and is also stimulating the jihadi terrorism that traces back to Reagan administration programs to organize, arm, and train radical Islamists, not for the defense of Afghanistan, as was proclaimed, but for the usual and ugly reasons of state, with grim consequences for the tormented people of Afghanistan, and for Pakistanis, and for the world, as the Reaganites cheerfully tolerated Pakistan's slide toward radical Islamic extremism under the rule of Zia-ul-Huq, who's one of the many brutal dictators supported by the current incumbents in Washington and their mentors then and today. We may recall that one of them has the familiar name Saddam Hussein, and they were also Reagan and associates looked away politely while their Pakistani ally was developing nuclear weapons, annually endorsing the pretense that Pakistan was not doing so. And as we should know, they were also helping their friend Saddam Hussein to do the same. That continued long after the after Saddam's worst atrocities, and also long after the war, the end of the war with Iran. And we also know the reasons, at least if we want to, because they were kind enough to tell us. Interesting reasons, all worth remembering. McGuire reminds us of something that is barely known. So remind isn't quite right. The fact is that in 1986, recognizing what he calls the dreadful logic of nuclear weapons, Mikhail Gorbachev called for their total elimination. That proposal foundered on Reagan's militarization of space programs, what are called Star Wars. NATO doctrine at that time, McGuire points out, as I said, he was one of the planners, was explicitly premised on the credible threat of first use of nuclear weapons, and that continues to be policy today. Russia kept to the same doctrine until 1994, when it reversed its stand, adopting a no first use policy and calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons. Now, that was a very hopeful step, but Washington's reaction and our inaction, which is worth remembering, quickly brought these quite hopeful prospects to an end. Russia reverted to NATO doctrine and abandoned its call for abolition of nuclear weapons. That was in response to Clinton's expansion of NATO in violation of Washington's categorical assurance to Gorbachev that if he would agree to a reunited Germany remaining in NATO, then the NATO alliance would not expand eastward to absorb former members of the Warsaw Pact. That was the assurance violated by Clinton. And in the light of recent history, not to speak of strategic truisms, Clinton's violation of these firm pledges posed a very serious threat to Russia, a serious security threat. Clinton's violation of these assurances also explains why NATO rejected Russian proposals for a nuclear weapons-free zone, including Central Europe from the Arctic to the Black Sea. That would have interfered with Clinton's plans to extend NATO eastward in violation of the firm commitment not to do so. All of this, of course, enhanced the likelihood of apocalypse soon, which is rarely a high priority for planners. Actually, the low priority assigned to national security is so abundantly illustrated that it takes real effort to miss it. So take the war in Iraq. It was undertaken with the expectation that it would probably increase terror and nuclear proliferation. Now, U.S. and other intelligence agencies and analysts confirm that that's exactly what happened. So to take just one of many examples, last May, the CIA reported, quoting, that Iraq has become a magnet for Islamic militants similar to Soviet-occupied Afghanistan 2 decades ago and Bosnia in the 1990s, and also that Iraq may prove to be an even more effective training ground for Islamic extremists than Afghanistan was in al-Qaeda's early days, because it is serving as a real-world laboratory for urban combat. The invasion of Iraq also had the predicted effect of greatly strengthening the popular appeal of anti-democratic radicals such as those of al-Qaeda and other jihadi Salafis throughout extremist Islamic fundamentalists throughout the Muslim world, still quoting. Terrorism specialist Peter Bergen says that President Bush is right that Iraq is a main front in the war on terrorism, but this is a front that we created, he says. As the Iraq war has expanded the terrorist ranks, the year 2003 saw the highest incidence of significant terrorist attacks in 2 decades, and then in 2004, astonishingly, that number tripled. In response to Donald Rumsfeld's search for what he calls metrics to know if we're winning or losing the war on terror, Bergen suggests that an exponentially rising number of terrorist attacks is one metric that seems relevant, actually very relevant since it was anticipated. Sometimes the threat is accelerated in quite remarkable ways. So it's common to say that no weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq after exhaustive search. But that's not quite accurate. There were WMD facilities found in Iraq, namely those that were provided to Saddam in the 1980s by the U.S. and Britain and others. The storage sites had been secured by UN inspectors who were dismantling the weapons. But the inspectors were dismissed by the invading armies, and the sites were left unguarded. The inspectors did continue to carry out their work using satellite imagery. They discovered massive looting of these installations in over 100 sites, sophisticated, careful, massive looting that included, they knew what was there, that included equipment for producing missiles, biotoxins, other materials usable for chemical and biological weapons, high-precision equipment capable of making parts for nuclear and chemical weapons. Where they went, we prefer not to guess. The ironies are almost inexpressible. And they should be front-page headlines every day in the newspaper. The official justification for the U.S.-UK invasion was to prevent the use of WMD that did not exist. The invasion provided the terrorists who had been mobilized by the United States and its allies with the means to develop WMD, weapons of mass destruction, namely the equipment that they had provided to Saddam, caring nothing about the terrible crimes they later invoked to whip up support for the invasion. It's as if Iran were now making nuclear weapons using fissionable material provided by the United States to Iran, which may indeed be happening. That brings us to another imminent crisis, Iran's nuclear programs. Well, that's a serious problem. No sane person wants Iran to develop nuclear weapons. And there are constructive steps that can be taken to prevent that. But first, again, we have to pay some attention to what is in fact happening. Those who hold the clubs typically take the position that history is bunk, old-fashioned, irrelevant, don't have to waste time on it. The victims don't have that luxury, nor do those who want to understand the world instead of just having blind faith in their dear leaders, to borrow the North Korean expression, which applies all too aptly, I'm afraid. Let's have a quick look at a little recent and current history that Iranians know very well and rightly regard as highly pertinent, although it's swept under the rug here. To begin with, Iranians remember very well that the policies that Washington is now condemning are the very same policies that the U.S. advocated before the 1979 overthrow of the Shah, that is, the tyrant who was imposed by the U.S.-UK military coup in 1953 that destroyed parliamentary democracy in Iran. Today, the standard claim is that Iran has no need for nuclear power, so it must be pursuing a secret weapons program. So Henry Kissinger explains that for an oil producer such as Iran, nuclear energy is a wasteful use of resources. That's now. When the Shah was in charge, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger held that introduction of nuclear power will both provide for the growing needs of Iran's economy and free remaining oil reserves for export or conversion to petrochemicals, and the U.S. Acted to assist these efforts with Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Rumsfeld also playing significant roles. U.S. universities were arranging to train Iranian nuclear engineers, doubtless with Washington's approval, probably Washington's initiative. My own university, MIT, for example, where that was done over enormous student opposition when the news leaked. Kissinger was asked about his reversal, and he responded with his usual engaging frankness. He said, well, then they were an allied country, so therefore they had a genuine need for nuclear energy, precept 1979. But today they're an enemy, so of course they have no such need. Well, Iranians may not be impressed by the logic. Washington's charges about an Iranian nuclear weapons program may for once be accurate. Many analysts have observed that it would be remarkable if they were not accurate, even though we have no evidence for it. Well, as I mentioned, it was anticipated that the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq would increase not only terror, but also nuclear proliferation. And it's now widely agreed that both predictions were confirmed. Reviewing these conclusions, one of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, writes that after the invasion of Iraq, had the Iranians not tried to build nuclear weapons, they would be crazy. The reasons are straightforward. Washington has gone out of its way to instruct Iran on the need for a powerful deterrent, not only by invading Iraq, but also by strengthening the offensive forces of its Israeli client, which already is the regional superpower, already has hundreds of nuclear weapons, as well as air and armored forces that are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the U.S. Small country, but as an offshoot of the United States, that can happen, and it does. For several years, Israel has been receiving the biggest shipment in its history of advanced U.S. jet bombers, very publicly advertised as capable of bombing Iran, also equipped with unspecified special weaponry, a term that's meant for the ears of Iranian intelligence, and deep penetration bombs. Well, Iranian President Ahmadinejad has been criticized, rightly, for outrageous statements. But just try to imagine what the reaction would be if he would go on to announce that Iran is preparing to bomb the United States and Israel and taking very credible steps to do so, well, the country would be blown away. But the imperial mentality that's been instilled by centuries of history ensures that Western leaders are exempt from any such strictures and are free to act as they like when dealing with the lower orders. That's just instinctive, so requires no comment. It's agreed on all sides that Iran's current activities, at least as far as they're known, fall within its legal rights as a signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a central part of the thin thread on which survival hangs. Article 4 of the NPT grants non-nuclear states the right to produce fuel for reactors. Now, Washington demands that Article 4 should be revised and restricted, and in fact a good case can be made for that. The Article 4 option made sense in 1970 when the NPT came into force. But with contemporary technology, producing fuel for reactors is just a step away from nuclear weapons. So restriction of Article 4 is perfectly sensible. However, any such revision of Article 4 would have to ensure unimpeded access, as the treaty says, for non-military use. That's part of the NPT bargain. Actually, a reasonable proposal for that was put forth by Mohammad El-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, last year's Nobel Peace Laureate. His proposal was that all production and processing of weapons usable material should be restricted exclusively to facilities under multinational control, accompanied above all by an assurance that legitimate would-be users could get their supplies. That should be the first step, he proposed, towards fully implementing the 1993 UN Security Council resolution calling for what's called a fissile material cutoff treaty. In shorthand, it's referred to as FISBAN, which would cap and make public all inventories of fissile material still available. El-Baradei's proposal, which is quite reasonable, was dead in the water. The U.S. political leadership, surely in its current stance, would never agree to abrogate its unique exemption from international law and treaty obligations. So Washington's call for restricting Article 4 is regarded by much of the world, quite rationally, as the cynical intention to convert the NPT to a convenient instrument of U.S. foreign policy, quoting McGuire again. Well, to my knowledge, there is only one country that has officially accepted El-Baradei's proposal, namely Iran. On February 16th, Iranian spokesman and top nuclear negotiator Ali Larijani stated, quoting him, that should a credible international system for providing nuclear fuel be in place, the Islamic Republic of Iran would be ready to procure its nuclear fuel from that system. Well, that would terminate the crisis and be a great advance forward in preserving the species. Well, does Iran really mean it? There's only one way to find out. But that path can't be taken as long as the facts are suppressed. I doubt if any of you have heard them, including Washington's flat rejection of El-Baradei's proposal, or in fact any proposal that would limit its unique authority to do what it likes. Article 4 is one of two paired articles of the NPT. The other's Article 6, which obliges the nuclear powers to make good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons. That's a binding legal obligation, as the World Court determined a decade ago. None of the nuclear powers have lived up to their commitments, but the U.S. is far in the lead in rejecting them and is alone in officially rejecting. The There was a regular 5-year review of the NPT. The last one was last May. It was a total disaster. There was press coverage, but it kept to Washington's agenda, blaming the failure on Iran. In the real world, the primary reason for the collapse of the conference was Washington's rejection of all serious prior commitments. That was explicit, and its announcement that it is exempt from Article 6. That's not to speak of its open plans to develop new nuclear weapons, apparently underway. Well, if that's not abrogated, that stand essentially terminates the NPT with awesome consequences for proliferation. Another central part of the NPT compact was the commitment of the nuclear powers to enact and implement additional treaties. That includes the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was rejected by the Republican Senate in 1999 and declared off the agenda by Bush. The ABM Treaty, which Bush rescinded, and most important, a verifiable fist ban, which would prevent any further additions of nuclear bomb material to the vast amount already existing. In July 2004, Washington announced its opposition to a verifiable fist ban on the grounds that effective verification would compromise core national security interests. Nevertheless, in November 2004, the UN Committee on Disarmament voted on a verifiable fist ban. The vote was 147-1 with 2 abstentions, Israel, which is reflexive, and Britain, which is more interesting. The British ambassador explained that Britain supports a verifiable fist ban but had to abstain because this version had divided the international community, namely 147-1. Well, that gives us some insight into the ranking of survival of the species among the priorities of the leadership of the hegemonic power and its spear carrier, and of their information systems, too. Now, this is probably maybe the most important vote in the history of the UN. As far as I can determine, it was not even reported outside of specialist journals, and the whole matter is unknown to the only people who can do something about it, namely the general public. Well, a few days later, the General Assembly again called upon all states, quoting, to contribute actively to the objective of the peaceful use of outer space and of the prevention of an arms race in outer space, and to refrain from actions contrary to that objective. The resolution passed 178-0 with 4 abstentions, the United States, Israel, Haiti, and Palau. The vote again reveals priorities, as does the coverage. In the United States, as far as I can determine, 0. These are very good ways to march on following our leaders to an Armageddon of our own making. Let's go back to Iran. Several years ago, the European Union and Iran, as you know, reached an agreement on Iran's uranium enrichment programs. That we know, but not what the agreement was. Here's an account of it by one of the most respected specialists on these topics, Zelic Harrison, writing in the world's leading business journal, the London Financial Times. He writes that the nuclear negotiations between Iran and the European Union were based on a bargain that the European Union, held back by the United States, has failed to honor. Iran agreed to suspend its uranium enrichment efforts temporarily. The EU promised to put forward proposals for economic incentives and security guarantees. The language of the joint declaration was unambiguous, he says. Here's what it was. A mutual acceptable agreement would not only provide objective guarantees that Iran's nuclear program is exclusively for peaceful purposes, but would equally provide firm commitments by the EU on security issues. Well, everyone understands the meaning of the phrase security issues. It refers to the very credible U.S.-Israeli threats and preparations to attack Iran, which is no joke for a country that's been tortured by the global superpower for 50 years, including Washington's support for Saddam Hussein's murderous war against Iran, the superpower that now occupies the countries on Iran's border, and that's not to speak of the regional superpower that's its client state. Well, Iran lived up to its side of the bargain, but the EU, under U.S. pressure, rejected its commitments and refused to discuss security issues. Iran then abandoned the bargain as well. That's where we are now, not quite the way it's portrayed. The background is extended by British physicist Norman Dombey. He's long been active in efforts to implement the Russell Einstein plea. He reviews the same picture, and he adds that the United States turned down Iran's offer to discuss security matters, including the nuclear program, in May 2003. And as he points out, the Bush administration followed the same course with North Korea when it took office in January 2001. It refused to confirm that it was bound by the no hostile intent statement of earlier agreements, then went on to issue serious threats, and it abandoned the promised fuel oil shipments and the reactor project. North Korea withdrew from the NPT, locked out the inspectors, started up its plutonium producing reactor and processing plant, and later announced that it possessed nuclear weapons, all as anticipated. Well, it's clear enough how to reduce these grim prospects. Case of Iran, in both cases, in fact, call off the threats that are practically urging Iran to develop nuclear weapons, join with the rest of the world, most of it, in taking steps to reintegrate Iran into the within the global economy, and accept the Fishbane Treaty, which leading specialists here regard as the most fundamental nuclear arms proposal. That's Princeton physicist and arms control specialist Frank von Hippel. And then move on to the legal obligation to close down the nuclear arsenals. In fact, even steps in those directions would mitigate the upcoming crisis. We might ask why Washington is so intent on punishing Iran that it's even willing to increase nuclear proliferation and the threat of nuclear war. Actually, that should come as no surprise to anyone familiar with the record of internal planning and of history. So why did the United States insist on bombing Serbia in 1999? Well, there's a standard claim that the goals were humanitarian. Now, that was at once exploded, even by the rich documentary record provided by official Western sources. But by now, the real reasons have been provided by high officials of the Clinton administration who were in charge of the enterprise. Quote, "It was Yugoslavia's resistance to the broader trends of political and economic reform, not the plight of Kosovar Albanians, that explains NATO's war." In brief, Serbia was not following orders. That's familiar too. So why has the United States been torturing Cubans for over 45 years? The internal record from the early 1960s is quite explicit. The reason was what it calls Cuba's successful defiance of U.S. policies going back 150 years. And that means going back to the Monroe Doctrine, no Russians, but the Monroe Doctrine, which declared that the United States is to be the ruler of the hemisphere. And you don't tolerate successful defiance of that. You don't understand why. Just ask your favorite mafia don. He'll explain it to you. Iran falls into the very same pattern. It's a familiar one. Another factor accelerating the threat of terror and nuclear war is the U.S.-Israeli rejection of the broad international consensus on a diplomatic settlement of the Israel-Arab conflict. It's now been going on for 30 years, the rejection. The first U.S. veto of a Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement on the international border was in January 1976, and the record then continues. And it continues as we meet with ongoing U.S.-Israeli programs to take over the valuable lands and resources of the West Bank, leaving unviable cantons, which are virtually separated from one another and from whatever fragment will be left of Arab East Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestinian cultural, educational, commercial life and institutions. All of these are now to be imprisoned within Israel with U.S. backing, as always. As Israel proceeds, it's now official, it's already been clear, but it's now official that Israel will proceed to take over the Jordan Valley and gradually expel its inhabitants, leaving the cantons prisons, basically. Just take a look at a map, and you'll see what all of this means. Well, there's a lot more to say about that and about the Hamas victory, but time's pretty short, and that would take us too far afield, so maybe we can return to it. The critical question today is, of course, Iraq. There has been a lot of talk about exit strategies, but none of that can be taken seriously unless it faces some fundamental issues that are sort of kept out of sight for doctrinal reasons, but surely dominate the thinking of policy planners. Now, we hear plenty of impressive rhetoric about Washington's dedication to a sovereign and democratic Iraq, but a moment's thought suffices to show that any such outcome would be a nightmare to Washington planners. That's why the occupying authorities fought so hard to prevent elections, and when they couldn't prevent them, turned at once to trying to subvert them. We should remember that and be impressed by the fact that elections took place at all was a real triumph of nonviolent popular resistance that the occupying armies couldn't handle. And the reasons are pretty obvious. Just consider the policies that a sovereign and moderately democratic Iraq would be likely to adopt. Well, Iraqis may have no great love for Iran, but they would prefer friendly relations with their powerful neighbor to antagonism and conflict. Furthermore, the Shiite religious and political leadership has very close traditional links with Iran, and these are now expanding. Shiite success in Iraq is already invigorating the pressures for freedom and rights among the bitterly oppressed Shiite populations right across the border in Saudi Arabia. These tendencies will only increase if Iraq gains some measure of sovereignty, which that happens to be the region where most of Saudi oil is. So the outcome, just think it through, could well be a Shiite-dominated alliance comprising the major oil-producing regions of Iraq, which are enormous, Iran, and the major oil regions of Saudi Arabia, all independent of Washington, and controlling the bulk of the world's energy resources. Now, that could mean that the United States would lose control over the world's major energy supplies. These have long been recognized to be, quote, documents of the 1940s, a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history.